Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. It is a combined 1,000 event in Indian Wells, and that means extra podcast time. We come to you with 3 days of play remaining in tennis paradise, certainly tennis paradise for pests and insects. Just a little hint at what's to come on today's show, which I rather suspect is quite a lot of bee chat. David's here. How are you doing, David?
I'm all right, but no bee puns, because I very, very quickly got sick of them last night. but wow. I mean, never before have I ever seen anything like it.
Yeah, Matt is here, and I'm not sure Matt is in a position to promise no bee puns. Matt is high on all things bee. Hello, Matt.
I had so much fun last night. Like, honestly, some of the most fun I've had watching sport this year, I think, with all the bee drama. Although I am with David, I was getting a bit sick of the bee puns, and I did actually say to myself that the first person I see tweet, "You cannot be serious," I was going to block. And then that person was Judy Murray. So I thought, oh no, I better not block her.
There was quite a lot of behave. You cannot be serious. Anyway, we've fallen down the rabbit hole very, very early here, but we just can't help ourselves. It is not often, if not ever, that play gets stopped due to a bee invasion, and that those words are very quickly mocked up on a graphic for the tennis watching world to see. Yet there is lots to get into on the tennis and bee front from the last few days in Indian Wells. And before we do all that, I'm going to tell you about On Location, our partners this week, the premium hospitality and experience provider. We're sponsored by On Location throughout Indian Wells and very proud to be so. On Location has incredible travel and VIP ticket packages, and I really do mean VIP. They are luxtastic, available for all of the sport's biggest events, so Miami, Roland Garros and the US Open, and of course they don't come any bigger than Wimbledon. There's this event. It's called Wimbledon. It's great.
You may have heard of it.
Courtesy of On Location and Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours, you can take your pick of amazing debenture packages. It's a word, debenture, that you don't hear in any other context besides Wimbledon, right? Does it even exist in any other context? Who can say?
I'm not aware of it, but I get a bit of a...
I just conceptually know what it means at Wimbledon, which is really, really great seats to watch tennis.
I know I get a sizzle of excitement and can't afford it. But it sounds great and I wish I could.
The packages include brilliant centre court and number one court tickets, a dedicated entry point into the grounds of the All England Club, exclusive access to debenture areas, and I've been adjacent to some of those areas before. Of course, not not well-to-do enough to be in any of them, but I've been Debenture area adjacent in the past, and they sure do look nice. And you'll stay at the five-star JW Marriott Grosvenor House Hotel. Grosvenor, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm like Jimmy Fallon going through how to pronounce the Marchioness of Chumley. Is it Jimmy? One of the Jimmies. Anyway, Grosvenor House Hotel. And if that's not enough, there's also the additional option of going on a luxury seven-day cruise to Croatia, which David can tell you is one of the most beautiful countries in the world. David basically works for the Croatian Tourist Board.
I would happily. I tell you, what a combo. I realise we are sponsored by On Occasion and therefore we have to promote this stuff. But actually, I kind of want to promote the fact that they take people to Wimbledon, give them an amazing time, and then maybe offer them a seven-day cruise to Croatia, which is, by my reckoning, the most beautiful country in the world. So, yeah, do it. Do it!
And it's a very good place to cruise around, I believe. My dad, Captain Whittaker, has been on a number of sailing holidays to Croatia. Lovely, sparkling, clear blue waters. So just go to toursfortennis.com/Wimbledon, which whenever I say that word now, which as a tennis podcaster I do a lot, I hear it in Matt Roberts impersonating Wimbledon announcer voice. At Wimbledon, toursfortennis.com/Wimbledon to choose your package to Wimbledon, which takes place between the 1st and the 14th of July this year. That's toursfortennis.com/Matt.
Wimbledon.
No, you said it wrong.
He's experimenting. He's branching out into different pronunciations.
Anyway, without further ado, we have arrived at the B portion, the official B portion of the show. We've got to lead with the Bs, haven't we? And we've got to lead with Lance Davis, the B guy. Matt, would you like to talk us through the sequence of events that we witnessed? Well, it was late last night for us, but it was mid-afternoon Indian Wells time. Take it away.
Well, it began as just an ordinary tennis match between Carlos Alcaraz and Alexander Zverev. I think they were a couple of games into the match. And then suddenly, out of seemingly nowhere, just thousands upon thousands of bees descended on the court, mostly surrounding Carlos Alcaraz, who was just very flustered, understandably, by the whole thing, and was, you know, waving his racket around trying to get them away from him. And he ended up being stung on the forehead, and he sprinted off court very quickly. And Mohamed Layani made an announcement while sort of climbing down from his chair to get away from the whole situation. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, play is suspended due to bee invasion." And then the cameras started really picking up on quite how many bees there were. And it was just, I mean, they were everywhere. They were all over the court. It seemed that they were particularly attracted to the spider cam. Presumably that was where the queen bee had gone, and they'd all followed. And there were just thousands of bees on this spider cam, which they were gradually moving up and away from the court. And honestly, it began as something that was a little bit harrowing and terrifying. It was quite scary, quite how many bees there were.
A little bit? I was really worked up about it. It was horrible.
And it was also clear it was going to take a very long time to sort this out. So there was a long time where all we were watching on a screen was just bees everywhere on the court, the players backstage waiting for them to be cleared. And honestly, it started to get a little bit boring. I was like, okay, I don't know how long this is going to take. I'll probably do my skincare routine and go to bed and wake up in the morning and find out the result of Alcaraz Zverev. But just as that was happening, my new hero appeared on the screen, Lance Davis. He appeared there was like this sort of cinematic shot of him at the top of the stadium, and he was just holding a vacuum cleaner. And it was like, hang on a minute. Is this our guy to sort out this apocalyptic bee situation? It was very much giving lying judges with a net trying to sort out the snake that we had earlier in the year in Australia. It was like, okay.
Well, the snake guy was just a guy with a bag, and the bee guy was just a guy with a vacuum cleaner. I say just a guy.
Or that so is... we thought.
Matt went into tennis relived mode very quickly.
Well, I noticed he was wearing a T-shirt that said "Killer Bee Live Removal." So I googled.
This is a guy that understands PR.
So I googled "Killer Bee Live Removal," and I was greeted with. I mean, to be honest, he seems to already be a celebrity, and the tennis world was slow to getting to know him. But, you know, he's been doing his thing for many years. Lance Davis, president, CEO, whatever you want to call it, of Killer Bee Live Removal, which when you put him into Google at the time, it came up with his Google reviews, which was 3.7 stars from 22 reviews. Lance Davis, Killer Bee Live Removal, has been servicing the home and business owners of Palm Desert for over a decade with bee removal and bee relocation services. Lance is a master and somewhat of a bee whisperer, if you will. All it takes is one conversation with him to see how passionate he is about his art. Don't call the rest, call the best. So that's his blurb. 3.7 star reviews. Someone accused him of stealing money from their grandmother, saying he was a ripoff and a typical con artist. And some people were saying that he was like the best guy in the world, considerate, respectful, kind, like just awesome. Anyway, he then starts vacuuming up these bees. At quite a rate, you know, he's doing an absolutely stellar job. But the most like incredible thing is he's not wearing any protection whatsoever. He's just got his shades on, his vacuum, and his Killer Bee Live Removal branded T-shirt, and he is sorting out Indian Wells for us, a hero of our times. The more deep diving you do, the better it gets. It turns out that he was in a coma for 3 weeks recently, and that. That may or may not be the reason why he ripped off that person's grandmother, because he simply wasn't able to pay them back because he was in a coma. But he survived his car crash, thankfully. And he's also brought out a reality TV series where he is known to his followers, fans, disciples, if you will, as the King Bee. And it says, Lance is the only maniac fearless enough to perform the live removal of these deadly insects with no protective clothing.
Oh, so it's part of his bit. The lack of protective
Absolutely.
Clothing is okay.
Yeah, he's doing
it's
this
like an
up
anti-costume.
And down Palm Springs.
Okay.
And so, yeah, they moved the spider cam to a sort of safe area in the stands. They sort of evacuated everyone, and he was just doing his thing. And then once he'd finished, he sort of came down to the court via the stands, and he was taking selfies with people and high-fiving everyone. I should say, actually, he wasn't killing the bees. They did put out a statement, the tournament, to say that he uses a vacuum that filters the bees into a live catch cage, a natural and humane way to remove them from the site. But he's apparently been working with the tournament for, quote, approximately 7 years. Like, I would have thought they would have known like how long
which he was in a coma for a portion of.
Yes.
I was going to say, I don't want to get heavy on the bee thing, but in the UK, discourse around bees is almost quite reverent, isn't it? Because they've been really the bee population. They're very ecologically productive and important. To our ecosystem, and they've been very much under threat in recent years, and there's a very big bee protection push. So as much as I also revelled in Lance. I was very concerned about, well, not very concerned. I was observing that perhaps the reverence towards bees wasn't quite tonally the same in the Palm Desert as it perhaps is here. I'm sure they did go into a lovely protective cage and are now living their best life, but killer bee removal doesn't inspire massive confidence. But anyway, he did the job he was hired to do. Well done, Lance.
And now he's gone up from 3.7 stars on Google reviews to 4.4 because the tennis fans have flooded his page with positive reviews.
Excellent.
Someone's rates are going up, aren't they? Lance Davis has given us not only the gift of everything Matt described, and the look on Matt's face right now, which is like a young child at sort of Christmas and Hanukkah combined. But he's also given us post-beasting Alcaraz and the prospect of post-beasting Alcaraz against post-puke Sinner.
We're on the same wavelength, Catherine. I had the same exact thoughts.
How good was Carlos Alcaraz last night after being stung on the forehead by a killer bee? Not my words, folks. The words of professional bee removal guy Lance Davis. How good was he?
It was pretty good. It was pretty good. I mean, I have to say, I thought when he came out onto the court at the start of the match, I thought he was going to be really good based on everything I've seen all week. He just felt like the Alcaraz who won Wimbledon, the Alcaraz who won Miami a couple of years ago and Indian Wells last year. A guy who we haven't really seen, I don't think, since the first set and a half of that Cincinnati final against Novak Djokovic. I must admit, when this whole thing happened, I thought we could see a very different Alcaraz afterwards because he was freaked out. He was really obsessed with where they were. When he came back out, he didn't want to go down one end of the court when the knockup was happening. There's a couple of screenshots I've seen of him eyeballing a bee that's landed on his bag, and he looks like he's just absolutely terrified and also planning some sort of assault on the bee. But within a game or two, once he'd got over that, or at least even playing with it almost looked like he was trying to win quickly, so he didn't have to be out there for very long. And he just, the security that we've seen all throughout the last week or so, added to the spectacular. It was the very best of Carlos Alcaraz, I thought. It was all the things that have got us so excited over the last few years, plus the kind of world-class professional tennis player who doesn't look stressed, who doesn't look wild the way he has the last six months, the way he's looked sort of erratic. That wasn't there.
It's a completely different experience watching him, isn't it, at the moment than what it's been for the past 6 months. And it makes you realise how not quite right it has been watching him for the last 6 months. It's that feeling you get in your stomach of just being on the edge, and even going back to the Wimbledon final when he was obviously ultimately and on aggregate brilliant, but he still did the slow start thing. You know, he was awful in that opening set. I was so impressed last night against Zverev, a guy that he recently has developed quite significant problems against, that he was brilliant right from the off. He managed to find his level straight away, and that was after being stung on the forehead by a bee. I know we're joking about it, but stung on the forehead by a bee, that's no joke. We don't have enough evidence yet to know whether he's sorted out his slow starting issue. But on the basis of some evidence so far, it does seem like maybe he has. And there's just a looseness in his wrist, which has been absent for the past 6 months, I think, Matt.
Yeah, it's a totally different experience watching him. And there's been, I believe, if you talk to the Spanish press and if you listen to Alcaraz in his press conferences over the last few months or so, he's been talking a lot about how poor his like break point conversion has been. So he's been panicking a little bit on those big points, and maybe going for the spectacular rather than the safe plays. Well, yesterday he was absolutely awesome on his break points, really efficient. And I think that's been another improvement. Maybe it just comes with feeling better about his game generally. When you're then in the big moments, you sort of trust that your game is there rather than having to force it. And that seems to be the difference. I thought he was just much smarter against Zverev yesterday, targeting the forehand a lot more rather than, you know, I remember in that match at the Australian Open, it felt like Zverev was hitting so many backhands, which is obviously his best shot. But targeting the forehand in a way that was not giving Zverev much rhythm on his own forehand. It was a smart match, but also spectacular in places as well. And honestly, the prospect of that Carlos Alcaraz against this Jannik Sinner, just get me there now. I just cannot wait for that match, because like we know that they match up well. We know that they play incredible rallies and incredible matches, and if they both produce similar sorts of form to what they've been displaying this week and all year for in Sinner's case, like we are going to be in for a treat in that semi-final.
Nobody has got close to Jannik Sinner this tournament. I can't even remember. Who was he playing yesterday? It's like doesn't matter who's down the other end of the court. You know,
Lehechka,
he's so secure and solid now.
And this was Lehechka off the back of easy straight sets wins over Rublev and Tsitsipas. And watching those matches, Lehechka was hitting such a big ball. I mean, he has definitely one of the biggest backhands on tour, for sure. And you're thinking, okay, let's see if Lehechka can be the guy to cause Sinner, you know, some problems here. And it was never close, that match. Sinner broke, I think, in the third game of the match. And it was suddenly like, even though Sinner's got this, he's got a much slighter frame than Lehechka, and yet he was hitting the ball just as hard off both wings. And suddenly Lehechka didn't look like the big ball striker that he'd looked like against Rublev and Tsitsipas back-to-back, dominating them. He was being dominated by Sinner, and Sinner appeared to signal afterwards to his coaching team that he wanted to go out for a hit and a practice, which always feels like the sort of ultimate burn, doesn't it? When you've just swatted someone aside and sort of made out that it wasn't even enough work. And honestly, since like ATP stats started being collected, which is like 1990, only the big three and Sampras have had starts to a season in terms of number of wins in a row that can match what and better what Sinner is putting together now. He's putting up extraordinary numbers with this unbeaten run, which is now at 19 wins in a row, 16 this year, because obviously three were at the Davis Cup at the back end of last year. But of course, Alcaraz in the form we've seen yesterday would be his biggest test since the Australian Open, for sure. And honestly, probably this is the first time that I know, like, Sinner has always had a good edge in that matchup and in that rivalry. But Sinner, to me, feels like the favourite tomorrow in the semifinals in a way that probably hasn't been the case. I've probably always thought that Alcaraz was the favourite in those matchups. There's a slightly different dynamic to it, which I'm excited about as well. Like, I don't think it's possible for Alcaraz to sort of be an underdog, really, but there's a slight sense of that, and I'm sort of looking forward so much to it.
So, bearing in mind that some, if not many, people listening will have already seen Alcaraz Sinner, and what I'm about to ask you about will be in the past, David, what's going to happen?
I think it's going to be a classic. And I mean, I really think it could go either way. I don't have a strong feeling for it. I think I would say Sinner 2, because I actually think it is a bit of a matchup problem for Alcaraz when Sinner's playing well, based on the past. I think his security is such, and his movement is such, that he can draw errors from Alcaraz unless Alcaraz is absolutely on it. And I still think Alcaraz's top level is higher. I think he's top higher than anybody. I think what we've seen the last couple of years is when Alcaraz plays his absolute best, he's better than any of them, even Djokovic, to me. In it may be short spells, but I think he's unstoppable when he's at his absolute best. Don't know whether he's at his absolute best now, because he hasn't been tested yet to this degree. This is where he has to prove it. I actually think this is a really important match and a really important tournament for Jannik Sinner, because he's on this run. He's won his first Grand Slam title. He's suddenly elevated himself. I mean, you know, you think a year ago when they played each other, he was very much second fiddle to Alcaraz. He was the guy who'd got it all to prove. And I remember when I interviewed Darren Cahill that time, he was kind of pumping him up because I got the sense he thought I was probably slightly downplaying how good he already was. And I was talking in terms of potential. But I did think it was more potential at that time. He's proved it to this point, but he hasn't backed it up yet. This is the backing up tournament. He needs to go win this tournament, I think, Sinner, to put himself in the bracket of Djokovic of 13 years ago when he had his 2011 run and he won the Australian Open. And then he went and won the Sunshine Double. And then he goes and wins everything else all the way up until the French Open. And he clearly moved himself into a totally different bracket. But if Sinner were to go and now lose against Alcaraz or lose in the final, I think the edge would be taken off that feeling that actually he's now almost on his own for a bit, you know, form-wise, like in a form guide. You'd still say, obviously, Novak Djokovic is the greatest of all time, but he's having a bad run of form. Alcaraz is the highest potential, but he's had a bad 6 months. Sinner is absolutely at his peak right now. But will it last? So I think this is a really important one for him. And I'm fascinated by it as a result. I'm going to pick Sinner, as I did at the start of the tournament. I think Alcaraz is playing way better than I expected this tournament. But I'd still go Sinner, because I think he'll probably be able to just ride out the peaks and the troughs.
I don't disagree with David, but I do think that's slightly harsh. Like, I already think Sinner is in a new category. Like, I already think he's backed it up. I think the Australian Open was him backing it up. That to me was the question mark, the Australian Open. Like, we'd seen him go to a new level at the end of last season, and then for him to come out and win the Australian Open, that to me was, okay, this guy is a real deal now. And okay, he's won his first tournament after winning the Australian Open already in Rotterdam. I know it was, you know, only a 500 indoors, but that was still something that hadn't been done since, I think, Hewitt was the last man to win their first tournament after winning a major. He's rolled through to the semifinals of Indian Wells. Like, I don't know, I think I get what you're saying. Like, a big win over Alcaraz and winning this tournament would purely, like, totally cement it and take him to an even higher level. But like, if he loses to peaking Carlos Alcaraz, I'm not suddenly thinking, oh, Jannik Sinner's got it all still to prove. Like, I don't know. I think he's there. I think he's done it. And he can do more, but I don't feel like I'll be having any question marks over Sinner, even if he were to lose this match to Alcaraz, personally.
The other men's semi-final is Tommy Paul against Daniil Medvedev. And if it weren't for the B guy stealing everyone's spotlight, I would definitely have been leading this podcast with the fact that New Year, New Me, Daniil Medvedev seems very much to be in the bin. Because troll Daniil Medvedev is back, and I I, for one, am thrilled about it. It's maybe it's just the effect that Indian Wells has on Daniel Medvedev. It's like best laid plans just go out of the window. Yeah, it was the greatest hits, Medvedev against Rune in the quarterfinals last night, wasn't it? And it was delicious, David.
Yeah. It was. I mean, like, this was a good match. Rune has been good this tournament, and I mean, he was excellent against Taylor Fritz. The night before, he came from a set down and just played his highest level. It struck me how interesting Novak Djokovic's future will be, because the highest level of all these guys is now a real problem, and Rune is one of them. It's just that Rune hasn't been at his highest level for quite a lot of the time in the last 6 or 8 months. And he was in this tournament, and him against Medvedev is not a match I feel like I have a handle on. They've played each other twice before last year, both on clay, won one apiece. Didn't feel like either of them. I didn't think like either match was the two players at the best at the same time. So I was really fascinated to see them on hard court with them both seemingly quite fresh. And you know, Rune was competitive. Medvedev was outlasting him in rallies the way he does. And suddenly, in the first point of the second set, after Medvedev's got the first one on the board, Medvedev goes to the net, I think behind a drop shot, and he's just a bit of a sitting duck. And Rune rushes up with his two-handed backhand and smashes the backhand straight at the chest of Medvedev at point-blank range. The ball pops up into the air, and then Rune sort of punch volleys the ball straight past Medvedev's nose. And then Rune very briefly raises his hand and then turns his back and walks back to the baseline. Medvedev doesn't move. He stands there, leaning over the net, staring at Rune, seemingly not thinking that he's apologised. That's the first.
Yeah, he didn't see the little hand gesture.
Yes, and like there's often this debate about apologies, and is it the right thing to do? Is it a bit? Stop apologising to each other, you know. Just we're often sort of doing all this sort of thing. Well, here we got a situation where one guy had kind of apologised and then walked off. He'd done what he's supposed to do, but he hadn't made much of a meal of it, you know. The way some of them stand there, oh, I'm so sorry. I'll make sure you turn around at exactly the moment that I am apologising, so that we don't have a fallout. Rune is not like that. He waves his hand and he walks off. Medvedev doesn't see it. And he's not going to just stomach that. He wants to have this out. And he waits until Rune turns around at the other end of the court. And they're aware of each other's position, let's put it that way. Rune just sort of smiles and shrugs as if saying, well, what's his problem? It's too bad. And then Medvedev walks back to the baseline and does one of those, I'm looking at you, sunshine. I'm eyeballing you. I know what you're all about, okay? And you're going to get it later, sort of thing. The umpire is then approached by Rune to say, I did apologise. What's his problem? And Carlos Bernardo says, yeah, I know you did. Let's leave it. Then he calls Medvedev to the net. They do this brief shake of hands. And then they get on with the match. Really good second set. Two love Rune. He had his chances. Medvedev turns that around, wins the match. Handshake. Medvedev says, we're going to talk about this in the locker room.
Where are the Netflix cameras when you need them?
Yeah. And Rune goes, well, we can, but there's nothing to talk about. And then that's where we leave it.
I was waiting for some kind of tweet from Holger Rune / Holger Rune's mum saying he ran up to me in the locker room and shouted yar in my face. It was very disappointed that wasn't forthcoming.
I know. I turned on notifications for Rune and everything.
Didn't
come through.
That was a sensational breakdown, David. Just one point of order, which is that you missed out in the sequence. Daniel Medvedev rolling up his shorts to be underpants in a gesture that was definitely mimicry / mockery of Runa's trademark short / speedo look. Which is just right in the trolling sweet spot, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. What a gift Medvedev is when he's in that mood. And actually, tennis-wise, maybe Gilles Simon's tactics have been working, because I'm obsessed with who these 16 players might be that Medvedev apparently has sent Gilles Simon's way to devise tactical plans for. And I'd be pretty sure that Sebastian Korda would be on that list. He's someone who has caused Medvedev big problems in the past. And Medvedev, okay, didn't play well in that match. And he was very sarcastic in his interview afterwards about that. But he managed to get the win. And Grigor Dimitrov is someone who's beaten Medvedev 3 times as well. Okay, Medvedev's beaten him quite easily in the past sometimes, but those have tended to be indoors. When they've been in outdoor conditions, Dimitrov has really given Medvedev problems, but he was very efficient and very good at beating Dimitrov this week. And yeah, with a 1-1 head-to-head against Runa going into this as well, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily, because it's probably not enough data, but you know, those are 3 good wins, I would say, for Medvedev against players who've beaten him in the past. And yeah, I still don't think he's playing particularly well. No, I think he's playing really well, but I don't know what has happened to his serve. Over the last year or so, his serve has declined so much. It used to be one of the best serves in the world, and now it's... Well, it's not, and he's hitting a lot of double faults, and he's not getting the cheap points that he used to get with that shot. But the rest of his game and how solid he is from the back of the court, especially on these slow, not hard court, hard courts, it's so hard to get the ball past him, so hard. Runa was having to do all he could, and it ended up resulting in quite a lot of errors, because he was just having to hit through Medvedev, and it was so hard to do. If he can find his serve again, he's going to be probably as good as he's ever been. But without that serve, I do just wonder whether he can beat... Okay, he's got Tommy Paul in the semis, but I don't know whether he's got the level to beat a Sinner or Alcaraz in the final without that serve. Because kind of the one time he's found his serve over the last year or so was that US Open semi-final against Alcaraz. He suddenly was brilliant with it. But the rest of the time, it's sort of been... sort of been missing, and yeah, just feels like he needs to get that back.
Yeah, amazing how well he's doing without what we used to consider his biggest weapon. Incredible, really. So yeah, he's never lost to Tommy Paul. Played him a couple of times, so he'll be the favourite going into that one. But good to see Tommy Paul having a good run, kind of backing up the decent results he's had in the period between now and the Australian Open. We need to cover, don't we, before we move on to the women's results, Djokovic's loss, his big return to Indian Wells, his first time playing there in 5 years, lost in his second match to 20-year-old Italian, ranked outside the world's top 100, Luca Nardi. David, when you woke up and saw that Djokovic had lost to Nardi, what did you think?
Well, my first thought was for your brother, because Math is the person who introduced Luca Nardi into our lives in October 2022 with a WhatsApp message that we very quickly unearthed to try to remind ourselves what he'd spotted. And he was absolutely bang on about his qualities, you know. Not a big guy, but great mover, good forehand, good redirector of shots, and just, you know, a very well-balanced player. But not a particularly spectacular player, not somebody that you... Probably not the sort of player I would necessarily spot and be excited by. But when you actually saw him go toe-to-toe with Djokovic and play like this, you realise, crikey, he really has got something. But... he's not really broken through very much in the last year and a half, I don't feel like. We haven't talked about him really at all. He was a lucky loser here, and he lost to Davin Goffin. Got into the draw, got through, played brilliantly against Djokovic, a guy who he'd, you know, he said he'd got his poster on his wall, you know, when he was a young lad. And there was a bit of aggro in there where Djokovic thought there was a hindrance because Luka Nardi stopped mid-rally, thinking he'd lost it, but then realised he could get to a
Which was ludicrous, wasn't it?
I mean, yeah.
You know, heat of the moment, whatever. Plenty of players do take up ludicrous battles with the umpire in the match, but it was ludicrous. I think he had absolutely no claim on that being a hindrance.
No, he was wrong, Djokovic. And I think in a calm moment when he's not pissed off, frankly, he would accept that he was being silly. And maybe in the moment he thought he was right, but sometimes you just can't handle it. You're just so annoyed, you're just so irritated by the way it's going that you don't accept any sort of reason if it's against you. And look, he was so fed up of his own performance. That's what came through in his post-match interview, is that he couldn't believe how bad he was. And look, Nardi played well, but he needed a lot of help from Novak Djokovic not being anything like normal Novak Djokovic in order to win that match. And I did find it really interesting and quite surprising that Djokovic then pulled out of Miami or decided not to go. I mean, increasingly his stance has been, I only really care about the Grand Slams. And are these tournaments leading to any Grand Slams? No, they're not. So you can understand from that perspective, but it does put a bit of a premium on him getting going on the clay. I don't think there's no need to panic. I mean, he's lost in Monte Carlo and gone and won the French Open in the past. I'm quite sure he will get going. But he's had a few losses that are a bit surprising, not just one. You know, losing to Sinner in a best of five set Grand Slam in straight set or four sets, and then to lose this when it's his first match back is not what I expected. And I do think that he will want to get out of that run as soon as possible because other players will be encouraged.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised at Novak Djokovic's withdrawal from Miami because when I saw his comments after the Luka Nardi loss and how alarmed he was by his level, as much I kind of would have understand it. It would have understood it if he had just not bothered with Indian Wells and Miami and just gone, well, they're not building up to a Grand Slam. I've made it very clear what my goals and priorities are at this stage of my career. They're great events, but not for me anymore. I would have totally got that. But the fact that he committed to play them, he seemed pretty into playing the events, whether that's to do with the fact that he's not been able to for a while, I don't know, but whatever. And then seeing his comments after Indian Wells, I thought, after that loss, I thought what he would want desperately and urgently is an opportunity to try and play himself into form and find it again. And my initial reaction to the Miami withdrawal was that he's afraid of suffering another kind of aura-denting loss. Because I do think, the point you made at the end there, David, I do think the chipping away of the locker room aura is quite significant here. I think that has been a massive shield for Novak Djokovic over the past few years, and a well-earned one. You know, it's been a shield for all the great dominant players over the years. And I'm not. It's not like he's nothing without it. He's still the greatest male tennis player of all time. But I do think it is a significant loss to him. And I do think there's a fear there of it being chipped away at further. But yeah, it certainly puts pressure on his performances on the clay, doesn't it? I guess he's thinking, look, he lives in Monte Carlo. He trains in the Monte Carlo Country Club. He can now get what is it, nearly a month's worth of practice in exactly those conditions to come out firing on the clay, but puts pressure on that ability to come out firing on the clay.
Yeah, and I think as David said, he's taken some losses on the clay in the last few years in those lead-up tournaments. I think clay is the surface which takes him the longest these days to feel comfortable on and find his feet. You know, normally he's finely tuned by the time he gets to sort of Rome, Roland Garros, but those initial clay court events, whether they've been in Monte Carlo or Belgrade or Madrid, have sometimes been a little bit of a struggle for him over recent years. Personally, his Miami withdrawal made me think that perhaps he never intended to play that event in the first place. Like, I know, like, he would be automatically entered into Miami given his ranking and the fact that it's a mandatory event. So he would be on the entry list. And I just think it's very easy to not play much as he has been over the past few years when you're winning. So I think that probably would have been in his mind that he would do much better at Indian Wells than he did. And then his plan would be, okay, that was his event to get his form back. And then he's onto the clay, which is big for him this year, especially with the Olympics being on clay. Like, I do think his form on clay this year is such an important factor in his season. And I think maybe that was part of the reason why he was so irritated, the fact that, then he's got a decision to make about whether he needs to change his plan, because suddenly it's like, oh, I really didn't plan to lose in my second match here to Luca Nardi. Do I now need to change everything and go to Miami? It's almost like I could imagine there being a little bit of stubbornness there and him saying, no, I'm not gonna change my plan. I'm gonna stick with what it was, and I'm not gonna play Miami, and I'm gonna get ready for the clay. I don't know. I'm purely speculating, but it was a really poor performance to go with the one that he had against Sinner at the Australian Open. And I was kind of surprised how that hindrance situation like briefly fired him up, and like he obviously won that second set, but it also lingered as irritation for him in the whole match. He's usually so good at just using something like that as fuel, turning the match around and sort of moving on from it. But even at the end of the match, he was kind of still annoyed about it, seemingly with Nardi at the net. And yeah, he just was sort of irritated the whole time. And that's not a Novak Djokovic that we've become sort of used to seeing. And sort of off the back of the performances at the Australian Open, it's just this kind of curious thing. Yeah, he's in a fascinating place right now.
I can't wait to see him again. I assume it'll be in Monte Carlo, but yeah, I agree. It incredibly intriguing place in Novak Djokovic's career. We need to talk about the women's tournament. We've also got some politics to cover. So because of how much time the B guy took up, and how poor I am with timing discipline, we're gonna truck on. Maybe the tandem thing to talk about moving on to the women's draw is the loss of Aryna Sabalenka to sort of sneaky good Emma Navarro. Made me think of a conversation we had at the Australian Open, Matt, where well, actually a sort of two-part conversation. First of all, you bring it to my attention that Emma Navarro was seeded at the Australian Open. I mean, talk about something that had snuck up on me. Prior to you telling me that, if you'd asked me what Emma Navarro's ranking was, I would have said like 75 in the world or something. And there she is, seeded at a Grand Slam. And then on, I don't know, day three or something, day two of the Australian Open, Matt says, one of my targets for today is to watch a bit of Emma Navarro and try and figure out if she's good. And I can't remember what the upshot of that is, but certainly the upshot of watching her beat Aryna Sabalenka the other day was that she's pretty good. But nonetheless, this was a huge shock to me. As evidenced by the fact that I had picked, having lost Rybakina, my original pick, to illness, I lost Aryna Sabalenka, my second chance pick, just hours later to just being bad, because I think she was pretty bad in this. And it's one of those tricky ones where you don't want to take anything away from the person that that beat her, because plenty of people have lost to subpar Aryna Sabalenka, and she didn't. She stood up and beat her. But there were two things at play here, I think, Matt.
Yes, definitely. This was kind of the worst of Aryna Sabalenka, I would say. And I really appreciate that she can't be in Australian Open form all the time. Like, that was so good, and it was absolutely peaking for 2 weeks, basically. It was as good as you get. But I thought we'd really had a development with Sabalenka where she was slightly able to rein it in if it was going a bit wrong, you know, and she wasn't going to lose in a whirlwind of unforced errors quite so much anymore. But that is what this was, really. She just looked totally one-dimensional, and she was just going to hit the ball, and she was missing by big margins, and her volleying was really poor, and it was a kind of Aryna Sabalenka performance that we've seen in the past, but I thought that she'd sort of grown out of, I suppose, and developed away from. But I suppose crucially, she has been saving those better performances for the Slams. She's become so consistent at the Slams. And, you know, I'd still take her start to the season over anyone else's, because she won the Australian Open. She delivered where it mattered most. But yeah, like, since then, she hasn't found her best level, for sure. But Navarro, as you said, sneaky good. And kind of this was her first big moment, I suppose, sort of, because everything she'd done up to then had been so under the radar, as you said, climbing the rankings last year to get herself in a seeded position. She won her first title at the start of the season, but that was in Hobart, which, you know, is a nice event, but it's not one that sort of gets a huge amount of attention in the sort of lead up to the Australian Open there. And arguably just as impressive as the win over Sabalenka was the previous round, where she beat Alina Svitolina in a very high-quality match where, you know, Svitolina was playing well. And I think Navarro is one of those players who you need to take the time to watch. I think if you just watch her once, you might not really appreciate what she's doing on the court, because she's not flashy at all. I read in Matt Futterman's piece on The Athletic that she barely even fist pumps. Like, she feels uncomfortable doing it. And it was quite interesting that she was paired in the sort of pre-tournament mixed doubles tiebreak tens with Ben Shelton, and they won it. But I mean, they could not be more different characters on the tennis court. You know, Shelton is all about the show and the sort of rush of watching him play and what's he going to do next, you know, whereas Navarro is super solid, very scrappy. She sort of relies on her fitness to win a lot of matches. She sort of prides herself on that. She's got a good game. She can mix in variety, and she's strong off both wings, and she's just not flashy at all. So you sort of have to watch her to appreciate her, I think. And she's been highly impressive over the last year. She's won more matches on the WTA Tour this year, 2024, than anyone else. She's just been racking up the wins. And yeah, you sort of start to wonder how high she can go. I think she's in her early 20s. She went to college. She was the NCAA champion. So, you know, I think that can sometimes, because they're at college, you're not going to break through necessarily quite so quickly. But she's here right now and is rising. And yeah, she thoroughly deserved to beat Sabalenka, because she was by far the better player on the day.
Although she has lost
her next match.
Yeah, she lost out to Marissa Sakkari in the quarterfinals last night. Pretty impressive, actually, from Sakkari this, because Navarro had beaten her in the past. A lot of people were kind of expecting Emma Navarro to win this match. Sakkari has a new coach, David Witt. She's in one of her favourite places. This is a banker for her, Indian Wells, generally.
I am really in on her and David Witt as a project, as a storyline, a narrative to follow. I'm so fascinated by this, because they are so different as characters. David Witt is so calm and laid back, in his delivery at least. I don't know him as a person. I don't know what he's like insight, you know, and clearly he's a very good coach. He worked with, but he worked with Venus Williams and he worked with Jessica Pegula, who are both very calm as well. And Sakkari is all fire, and it's just, it's so appealing, but it has been her downfall to some degree, I believe, as well. And over the past few years, I think she hasn't reached her potential because of it. And she's probably got to go and at least reach the final of this to make me feel that there's tangible evidence that this is different. Because as you said, Catherine, this is the banker for her. Her record is great at Indian Wells. She, her game matches perfectly to this high bouncing court and the altitude and all the rest of it. And she's had her best stuff here. But if she were to now go and beat Coco Gauff, I don't know. I just think that David Witt making a difference to her is just one of those things. I really want to see that happen. I hope, I kind of, I like Maria Sakkari anyway, and I just and I think it's just a delicious narrative, especially because Jessica Pegula has also, you know, got a different setup obviously now as well. She hasn't started as well in her post David Witt career. Just fascinated to watch it develop. And I think Sakkari has a real chance against Gauff, because Goff's not playing very well. She's tough in matches out. She's doing what she does. But her serve was all over the place yesterday. She was so fed up with her serve. And so I actually think I would pick Sakkari to win that match.
Goff's having a weird tournament, isn't it? She's in the semi-final. She's had some great results. Yes, David, she's winning ugly, but that's how she won her Grand Slam. Like, it's a weird one, isn't it? Because you almost, when she plays ugly tennis, you kind of don't judge it in the way that you judge other players. You kind of think, oh well, you know, that's almost when she's at her best, because it's kind of indicating that she's in a good mental place and able to put the perfectionism to one side. But she is playing some quite ugly tennis, and particularly on the serve, it's not just that she's having issues with it, it's that she seems, Matt, to me, very in her head about those issues, whereas what I think one of the secret sauce of her US Open success was to get out of her own head about the things that weren't perfect in her game, the forehand issues, the occasional serve issues. She got out of her head about them and was just like, nobody's perfect, going to play through it, going to focus on my strengths. And I'm not saying that's all gone out of the window, but she does, to me, seem to be in her head about the serve.
Yeah, and I think that's an important distinction, because I think the serve is the one shot where if it's off, it's very hard not to be in your own head about the serve. Like, it's kind of embarrassing to be constantly double faulty. I mean, she hit 17 double faults yesterday. That's over four games worth of double faults. She only lost seven games in the match. Constantly putting yourself on the back foot. You know, you can, we've seen her forehand issues. You can get to a place where at least you can, you know, or she at least got to a place where she was getting the forehand in, even if she wasn't necessarily sort of hitting it as cleanly as she would like. She was managing it. She was coping with it. And in rallies, she could maneuver the rallies so to sort of cover it up or to bring out the rest of her game. And I think that helped her get to a good sort of mental place. But you can't escape the serve. You've got to be hitting serves. And if you're double faulting that often, I think it really does take it out of you and drains you and gets you down and gets you feeling bad about your kind of whole game if the one sort of fundamental shot, which is the serve, is so off. So, as you said, it's an incredible feat that she still managed to win that match yesterday against Yuan Yuri, who's been winning a lot of matches herself recently. And actually, I thought Gauff was really good against Elise Mertens. I mean, Mertens didn't play well, but I thought that was the best I'd seen Gauff play in a little while, certainly since the Australian Open. And there was this funny moment afterwards where obviously she turned 20. It was her birthday that day when she beat Mertens, and she put up a 2 and a 0 for 20. But that sort of just so happened to be the score against Elise Mertens. It was Love and Two. It sort of looked like she was slightly mocking Elise Mertens, which she absolutely wasn't. She was saying that she was 20, but it was quite a funny image. But like how she went from that performance against Mertens to the one against Yuan Yui in the following round, like there's real fluctuation at the moment, and I just don't really know what Coco Gauff we're going to get. And you can rely on her to compete, absolutely, and that will win her a lot of matches. It may well be enough even to beat Sakkari, but I'm turning on all Gauff matches, thinking, right, let's see where this goes.
Mm.
And that's quite a fun sort of feeling to have, but the double faults are not fun.
The other semi-final is world number one Iga Świątek against Marta Kostyuk, who's low-key putting together a really impressive season so far, isn't she? David and I both got second chance picks for the women's event, but having both originally picked Rybakina, and some of us were more smart with those choices than others. Picking the world number one, David, it's just generally quite a good way to go, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought I'd go out on a limb. And she a little like Sakkari, the place just suits her down to the ground with the high bouncing ball and, you know, the movements being important to get your feet in the right place and all that sort of thing with the altitude. She just looks in a really good place. I mean, she was a breakdown against Caroline Wozniacki, who's had a good run at this tournament, but then she pulled up injured at the start of the second set. I think she'd been struggling with her feet, and but it was turning around anyway that match. Although Wozniacki made a good start, but yeah, I am really impressed with Kostyuk this season. I like the way she talking about backing up. I like the way she's backed up her run recently, and to come out and do this, you know, it's impressive.
Yeah, agreed. Now, that's it in terms of the tennis in Indian Wells. We'll, of course, be back on Monday with a full Indian Wells wrap show. And actually, that podcast will be live on YouTube. That's going to be 8 p.m. on Monday night. And it'll round up everything that happens over the next few days at Indian Wells. It'll, of course, be available anytime as a podcast as well, if that is your preference. But the option will be there to watch it on YouTube. And if you fancy and you're free at 8 p.m. UK time on Monday night, that's 3 p.m. East Coast time.
Four. They've done their clocks in America.
No. I shouldn't have gone down that road, should I? Sometime in the afternoon in America.
Yeah. Correct.
Accurate.
If you fancy joining us live, we would love to have your company. And just while I'm doing the housekeeping, if you're a friend of the Tennis Podcast, next Wednesday, so less than a week from now, we'll also be doing a live Q&A show, and that'll also be on YouTube. We're doing monthly live shows for friends of the Tennis Podcast. They've been going, though I say so myself, they've been going really well. We've been really enjoying them, and we've got our next one coming up next week, so we're really looking forward to that. Of course, also with being a friend of the Tennis Podcast, you get all of our editions of Tennis Relived. We do 8 every year. The most recent of them went up last week, and it's about Ted Tingling. And again, though I say so myself, I do think it's a really special couple of hours of listening. We've had such a heartwarming response to it. We're just so thrilled that friends have enjoyed learning about Ted Tinling as much as we enjoyed learning about Ted Tinling. And that show also features the phrase denuding the tennis court of sequin spooge from Mary Carrillo. So it's worth becoming a friend, I would say, just to hear Mary say that. We have our 4 Grand Slam review shows with special guests and voice notes for friends of the Tennis Podcast. We have Hannah's monthly column, which has been going down a storm, and the next one of those is coming soon. And very soon, folks, we will also be launching our Friends Community Space. It's going to launch this month after Indian Wells. We've been having our final few meetings about what it's going to look like and what the functionality is going to be, all sorts of fun stuff. And we are We are so excited. You can't see this, but David is doing the face of a proud father as I talk about the Friends community space. It's been a long time coming. It's something we've wanted to do for a while, and we're really thrilled that it's finally happening. So if you'd like to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast, get access to all of that and support us in what we do, then the link to do so is in our show notes. We will be back in just a moment's time with a little bit of politics.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
So, Indian Wells, the tennis has been happening, the bees have been happening, the aggro between Medvedev and Rune has been happening, and of course, death taxes and politics in tennis. Things have been a rumbling. It's quite often the case that these sorts of things emerge during Indian Wells. It tends to be a place where the tours and the various different stakeholders in tennis have their meetings. If I were a stakeholder in tennis, I would probably suggest that Indian Wells is a nice place to have a meeting as well. If you've got to go to a corporate meeting, could it be in Indian Wells, please, to mitigate the boringness? But anyway, moving and shaking has been happening. We've heard a lot over the past few months about the creation of a so-called premium tour, spearheaded by Australian Open boss Craig Tiley and with the buy-in, apparently, of the other Grand Slam tournaments. This week, that story has moved on, courtesy of the reporting of both Matt Futterman from The Athletic and Simon Briggs from The Telegraph in the UK, friends of the show both. David, you've been very much across the story. You've been loitering on the lawn in spirit, if not in literal terms. What can you tell us?
Yeah, there's a lot to this story, and I think it's probably worth just going back a little bit to give a little bit of the history of what's been going on, not just in tennis, but in sports more generally. And that is really the spectre of Saudi Arabia hanging over all sports at the moment. Saudi Arabia, with their public investment fund, or PIF, as you may have seen it in the branding around sporting events, it wants to be heavily involved with sports. They would say to be involved because of a love of the sport and various things like that. Others looking from the outside in would say, well, actually, this is sports washing, and its purpose is to distract from human rights violations, their treatment of and laws relating to women and LGBTQ plus community. And to that end, Saudi Arabia has brought big name football or soccer players, as you may know them in America, players over to Saudi Arabia. They've hosted several world heavyweight title fights in boxing, and frankly, they've destabilized golf with the creation of the LIV Tour, such that this week's player championships, for instance, is devoid of stars such as John Rahm and Phil Mickelson and Cam Smith on the PGA Tour because they're on a separate tour. And in tennis, I think they've expressed interest. They've held some exhibitions. They've got another big one coming up with all the biggest stars in tennis in the next month or two. And I think that there's been a real fear within tennis about a LIV-style setup where the whole thing becomes fragmented to a point where you don't have the best players playing each other very often. So I think at the same time, it seems that Saudi Arabia has also not wanted that in tennis. So the progress has been slower. Many believe, I think, just to avoid that backlash and the standoff currently taking place in golf. And to that end, as well as the exhibitions, the PIF is now sponsoring, maybe some would say even effectively owning, the ATP rankings. And they want to do more than that, though. Last year, it emerged that Saudi Arabia wanted to hold a big Masters 1000 event in the first week of the year. They've made a play for the WTA finals, and that looks like it's now going to happen. There's appetite for both within the ATP and the WTA leaderships, but it's not universal. And Martin Navratilova and Chrissy Evert, two of the biggest names in the sport, wrote a combined column in the Washington Post to express their opposition to the WTA finals moving to Saudi Arabia. And then shortly after the Masters 1000 event reports came out, it was reported by Matt and John Wertheim and Simon, as you referenced, that the Slams, the Grand Slams, were really not happy about this, and particularly Craig Tiley, head of the Australian Open. The reason he's not so annoyed is because that Masters 1000 event would take place right when his lead up to the Australian Open takes place. So the United Cup would be compromised and all the lead up events there. So almost like as a counter offensive, he has created the concept of a premium tour, which we've been reporting about, talking about over the last few months. And that is effectively an elevated series of events which would kind of relegate the smaller events, the 250s, some of the 500s, to a kind of qualifying tour, and basically making the WTA and the ATP leaderships kind of bit part players. They would almost become irrelevant in that sort of structure. So there's a real standoff going on here as a result. Now, this week in Indian Wells, as you said, everybody sort of converges and comes together for all these big meetings, but it's pretty rare that you just get all the Grand Slams coming out to an Indian Wells. That's what's happened this week. And Simon Briggs reported in the Telegraph that these meetings took place to discuss the Premium Tour, all the four Grand Slams, the Tours, the ITF, all the biggest names in the sport together to try to see what that might look like and to put their various ideas on the table. And Simon was saying that whilst that meeting took place, it was then followed by Andrea Gaudenzi, the head of the ATP, staying behind with the other tour members after the Grand Slams had left and discussed this Premium Tour, because he wanted to effectively present a rival offer funded by Saudi Arabia to see whether there might be an alternative option, and inevitably one that would have Andrea Gaudenzi and the Tours at the heart of it. So there's a real power struggle going on here. These are two Goliaths, really, within the tennis world, and obviously with Saudi Arabia involved as well, which are sort of going toe-to-toe and staring each other down and presenting rival options. Simon reports that $1 billion is on the table for this this Masters 1000 event at the start of the year, and the WTA event at the end of the year might even be $2 billion when you factor both in. Those numbers are disputed at the moment. But, I mean, Gaudenzi, if you think back, has been talking for a long time about wanting to have the ATP and the WTA much more closely aligned, sharing digital rights, media rights, things that we've often talked about wanting to have. And frankly, we've talked about wanting the two tours to be merged. And they're both sort of promising a bit of the concept of these things without being explicit. And then you have the whole Saudi Arabia of it all. The one outline that I think is very interesting from John Wertheim, he tweeted the other day that the premium tour idea from the Slams, that it may not have the guaranteed Saudi dollars, but it is offering four majors, 10 combined 10-day events, all outdoors with equal prize money, a team event, a race rather than a 52-week ranking system, a combined WTA ATP year-end finals, and an 8-week guaranteed off-season. So they're both offering different things. Both of them have attractions and appeals. I really don't know where this is going to end up. And I think nobody does, really, because this is high-stakes stuff with two such significant players in the arena going head-to-head. Now, do they end up combining like they've tried to do in golf, and they've got that whole standoff, and how are they going to combine and come back together? Don't know where this is going to end up.
Just on that, the John Wertheim tweet, David, is it the case that the sense I've been getting with these two rival proposals is it's no longer, despite Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova and other dissenting voices, including ours, it rather than a debate about whether it's ethically appropriate for tennis to get into bed with Saudi Arabia, it seems to have moved on to me to an arms race of who can get the Saudi dollar quickest, who can align themselves with the Saudi dollar. I thought this was kind of two separate proposals, two rival proposals, each of which was vying for that purse and that buy-in. But perhaps have I got that wrong? Does only one of these proposals come with Saudi Arabia confirmed to be attached?
Yeah, that's how it would appear. From all the reporting that has been done, it seems that the ATP Gaudenzi proposal is the Saudi-backed one. And at the moment, there is no suggestion in the reporting that we've seen that the Slams are involving Saudi Arabian funding as part of their model.
So that's the premium tour proposal, which is the tour inclusive of the Slams. So it'd be four Slams and 10 combined 1,000 equivalent events. That's the one spearheaded by Craig Tiley. That is the one that currently looks like it has no Saudi Arabian involvement.
And I think it's almost in opposition to Saudi Arabian involvement, because I think it's almost like Craig Tiley's had the idea for the premium tour as a way of getting rid of the idea of Saudi Arabia taking that initial spot in the calendar with their Masters 1000 event, which, as David outlined, sort of ruins the build up to the Australian Open and destroys the United Cup, which Craig Tiley has sought to build. And I think there's also, in the reporting and everything we've heard, I think Wimbledon would certainly be hesitant to align themselves with Saudi Arabia. And certainly I think the LTA have been as well, haven't they?
Mm. They refused a sponsor for Queen's. One of the smaller tier sponsorships was from Saudi Arabia, a proposal, and they reportedly rejected that. I mean, listen, I think it is probably quite important to not say that nobody's come out and said it's because of human rights reasons that we are not taking this money. I mean, maybe there is some of that. And you know, I think Wimbledon certainly would feel at the very least queasy about the idea on some levels, but that has not been reported. This is about, hold on, you're trying to get our space in the spot in the calendar here and move us aside. No, we're not going to have that. We're going to move you aside and create our own. Is kind of what's happening at the moment. And I'm afraid, Catherine, I think it's a very valid point. I think Martina Navratilova and Chrissy Evert are not alone, but they're within the you may say they have nothing to lose. They can afford to be principled about it. But I'm afraid principles in this situation don't appear to be massively factored in as to whether this is the right thing to do. That should not be forgotten by us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think, I do think we're moving towards the stage of doing, you know, we're doing these friend shows, aren't we, that are a mixture of Q&As and with listener questions and themed shows that centre around a particular topic. The last one was called What Would We Change About Tennis? And we had lots of thoughts and feelings. I think we are moving towards doing a Saudi Arabia specific show, aren't we? I think just because it comes up so often and we end up having kind of a bit of discussion about it very frequently, that kind of prevents us from really, really having the discussion, deep diving, going to all of the horrible places that need to be gone to, and that frankly it feels like people aren't going to anymore. It does. That's what worries me. It just feels like the conversation has moved on to a place of just everyone's resigned to it. The resistance has been chipped away. I do feel like the watershed moment was the moment that John Rahm went to live for me. Anyway, that is a different podcast, and it is available. It's called No Laying Up. Great, great show. but yeah, it's in our plans to do a Saudi Arabia specific friends show. So if human rights abuses are your thing, then do become a friend of the Tennis Podcast and listen to us talk about them at length. Not the human rights abuses themselves being your thing, but just sort of general discussion thereof.
Good clarification.
I'm great at these promos, aren't I, David? awkward segue to talk about our mascot for this episode. It's Django. Django is a 22-month-old poodle. He enjoys driving in the convertible to each morning's adventure, park, hike or beach. I want Django's life. He likes eating watermelon in the afternoon and chewing ice at night. Beyond that, owner Steve says he's a world-class troublemaker and lover.
He's the coolest pet I think we've ever had.
Yeah, I mean, poodles are amazing. I'm not saying this isn't a gorgeous picture of Django. It is. He's looking right at the camera. He's got a great mullet going on. He's brilliant. But I would also, Steve, if you can, like a picture of Django in the convertible on his way to his morning adventure. There's nothing more joyful than a dog with their hair in the breeze, their ears flapping.
I just love this kind of what are you pointing that camera at me face. I love it.
Yeah, he's he looks like he just has got life figured out, does Django. They're incredibly intelligent poodles. So maybe he has got life figured out. Let us know. Thank you, Django. And thank you, Steve, for bringing Django into all of our lives. We have our mascots. I continue to disgrace the memory of the dearly departed Darwin. I am honestly trying my best, but it's not going well. David has Francis, and Matt has Hyder and Soma. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. She's asleep on my left hand at the moment. I've been doing the last 20 minutes of the podcast one-handed, which has been fine. We have top folks and executive producers. They are Jamie, Jeff, Chris and Greg. And Matt, we have shout outs.
Yes, I did notice earlier when Billie Jean popped into view that she was sort of yawning through the Friends promo. Yes. I was thinking, we won't be clipping up this bit for social media.
Or maybe we will.
Right, yes, yeah, shout outs. We start with Barthi Jayaram in Chicago.
Hello, right, Barthi. Chicago, former home of the Laver Cup.
Yep. Absolutely right. That's a good tennis reference, Catherine.
Thank you very much. I don't think she...
I think it used to have a WTA event.
Yeah.
I've got a feeling Martina Navratilova won a lot.
All the time.
The Windy City. The Windy City, which apparently it's not named that because of wind. I can't remember the specifics, but it's one of those sort of, you know... fact that if you go on an open bus stop tour of Chicago, it's the sort of thing the tour guide will tell you. But yeah. Thank you, Barthi.
And Barthi says, after years of watching tennis, I finally started lessons in my mid-50s.
Oh, love that.
Go Barthi!
Go Barthi. It is a game for life. That's what they say. Thank you, Barthi.
We've also got Trevor Anderson in Brick, New Jersey. We have so many friends in New Jersey.
So many. Wow. Hello, Trevor.
Trevor has a pug named Roger.
Named after Federer?
Named after Federer, of course. I got him in February 2018, right after Federer won the Australian Open. I didn't know it at the time, but that was Federer's last Grand Slam. Maybe my pug was a jinx.
Oh. tennis Trevor's, David.
Yeah, the only one I know is my dad, and given that he...
I was going to say, was he a tennis player?
He did like to do lobs. I remember that. And he used to tell me that that was his tactic, a very well-placed lob onto the baseline.
Like Andy Murray.
I would call a moon ball. Yeah. Well, this was when I was... about 4 foot, Matt.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, he sticks them on my baseline. I call them moon balls, you know. Mind you, our tennis court was basically the road outside of the house at that point. No, he wasn't very good.
Well, I can't think of any other tennis Trevors. So Trevor, like Trevor Law. Thank you, Trevor.
And finally, we have Reese. Just Reese. In Newcastle, Australia.
Oh,
Reese.
I think I might have driven through Newcastle, Australia, or been in the back seat of my car while my dad drove through Newcastle, Australia.
Reese says, not sure of any tennis players with my name. However, I do share my birthday with my tennis idol, Serena Williams.
Oh, very good.
Oh, that's good birthday.
Also, nervously, I did not say hello to Matt and Catherine at the Australian Open in 2022.
Oh, you should have done, Reese.
Always say hello.
Next time, Reese.
Tennis Reese's, David?
No.
Is it is it the Welsh spelling? Is it the more not Welsh spelling?
What's the Welsh spelling?
R-H-Y-S.
With an H and a Y.
Yeah,
it's the quote more not Welsh spelling.
Great, I've run out of words.
R-E-E-C-E.
It's officially or R-E-E-S-E, like the pieces. It's time to end this podcast now, isn't it? I've run out of words. Reese, thank you ever so much. Thank you to all of our friends and our shout-out friends, our intro friends, all of our friends. We, of course, have that live Q&A show for friends next Wednesday and our next main feed podcast coming to you on Monday after the finals of Indian Wells. We'll be live and on YouTube. So head to our YouTube channel. Links will be going out in our newsletter and show notes, all of that. We'll make it very easy for you to find us. But we have a YouTube channel. Do like and subscribe. That helps us a lot. And join us at 8 p.m. UK time on Monday for our next podcast. We will speak to you then.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.